Israel, Russia, and then Turkey. The amount of money spent exceeds $10 billion. That is absolutely established. It might be a little bit more, I don't know. Regarding the meeting on Friday with Secretary Pompeo, he is already on record as saying that the agenda will be de-escalation and return to the negotiating table, to the negotiation table. This is all fine, of course. The only issue that is left aside is how come a NATO member, Turkey, is involved in a war in which, of course, on the other side, there is Russia, and nobody is talking about that. There is a kind of free electron doing whatever it wants, and nobody is discussing that issue. The stakes are quite important because, for example, just yesterday, Azerbaijani troops have shelled Iranian villages on the other side of the border in Iran. Iran has already warned that it won't tolerate this type of things.
Well, we're going to
So
have
the
to leave it
conflict
there,
can
but we will
degenerate.
continue to follow this conflict. Professor Stefan Astourdian, University of California, Berkeley. And thank you so much to Rubina Margosyan of the EVNReport.com, where she's been recording from Nagorno-Karabakh. Again, happy birthday to Ravi Karan. Wear a mask and vote. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of L'Arche Portland Benefit Celebration on Saturday, October 24th from 6 to 7 p.m., streaming online. This benefit will highlight the gift of individuals with and without intellectual disabilities. There will be musical performances, an auction, and testimonials covering the mission and impact of L'Arche. Again, that's L'Arche Portland Benefit Celebration, Saturday, October 24th from 6 to 7 p.m. streaming online. You can find more information at kboo.fm on the right side of our homepage under Community Events.
Attention all KBOO members. Ballots for our board of directors election have been mailed out, so check your mailbox. Then make sure to tune in on Tuesday, October 27th at 10 a.m. or Wednesday, October 28th at 7 p.m. to hear interviews with your candidates for KBOO's board of directors. We'll be asking each of our candidates about their skills and experience to help you decide who to vote for. Again, that's October 27th at 10 a.m. or Wednesday, October 28th at 7 p.m. right here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, why Oregon is on a list of the top five states for election-related militia activity. A Portland center offers education and hope to the children of immigrants. And the Supreme Court nominee advances to the full Senate. The KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 22nd, 2020. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Annette Newell. A new report claims that Oregon is one of the top states most at risk for militia activity related to the election. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade has more in the story.
Oregon has been named one of five states that may be at risk for increased militia activity around the elections, according to a new report. Both ACLED, a crisis mapping project, and the research group Militia Watch concluded that Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Oregon could be potential hotspots for militia-style activities around election time. The range of activities that could occur includes everything from armed demonstrations to voter intimidation to planned acts of violence. Factors in the report were states where militias held recruitment drives and training, where there had been considerable involvement with anti-coronavirus lockdown protests, and where groups have formed relationships with law enforcement. Far-right, militia-style groups, such as the Boogaloo Movement and the Proud Boys, have been busy this year with evidence showing that their numbers are growing, their online presence is increasing, and their threats are becoming more specific and vitriolic. Though the individual goals from these groups may differ, the report shows what ties them together is the suspicion that President Trump could only lose the election if it is rigged. Hampton Stahl, the founder of Militia Watch, says, quote, "Their circulation of rumors of left-wing intervention at the polls and in the election, which has led to individuals and militia groups discussing showing up armed at the polls to see if anything suspicious or what they deem as suspicious is actually happening," end quote. Though social media giants Facebook and Twitter have cracked down on militia-style groups in attempts to avert their commentary and planning, these groups have moved their conversations to other, more remote social media networks that are more permissive with content and discussion boards, making them harder to track online. Though there are federal and state laws against voter intimidation, voting rights activists are concerned that attention generated by militias could depress voter turnout, further adding tension to an already deeply heated and divisive election season. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
The full United States Senate will vote on whether to confirm President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Amy Coney Barrett, on Monday. The Senate Judiciary Committee's Republicans voted to approve her nomination. They did it without bipartisan support because Democrats boycotted the vote. At a rally in the nation's capital, Oregon Democratic U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley spoke out against the move so close to the election.
Do we want government buying for the powerful or buying for the people? For the powerful or the people?
The people.
The powerful or the people?
The people.
Okay, good. I'm in the right place. But at this moment, this is the question that confronts our country. Because what we have in the process going on in the building behind us, in the Senate, is all about destroying the vision, the we the people vision of our Constitution. Now, I happen to really like the we the people vision of our Constitution. Do you like it? Do we like the Senate Republicans deciding to roll right over the top of it and corrupt the court for the powerful?
No!
Hell no! So that's why we're out here talking today. And that's why we're taking every single action we can. Because we are trying to set the stage for a potential outbreak of integrity. Wouldn't that be incredible? We have a whole group of 53 senators, almost all of them were here 4 years ago, and they said this. They said, we believe that we should listen to the people of the United States during an election year before there's a debate or a vote on a nominee. Remember that? They said it was an issue of deep principle. They said that they would stand by that principle in any given year. Well, what are they doing today? They're violating that principle straight out. They're saying, we don't want to listen to the people. We want to, in fact, hold the vote before the election so that the people cannot have an impact on our country and the preservation of the vision of equal justice under law. Now, if we look at the Supreme Court right behind us, and you look over the portal, you'll see those words carved in there, equal justice under law. How about that we actually fight day and night for equal justice under law? Are you ready to fight? So that fight's going to continue because maybe, just maybe, with thousands of Americans calling their Republican legislators, their Republican senators, maybe a few of them will say, you know what? I'm going to stand by the principle that I laid out 4 years ago. And I'm not going to vote to move this nomination forward. And we're going to wait and see what the people say on November 3rd. Are we willing to fight for that?
Yes.
So I want to tell you what. I'm hoping that outbreak of integrity happens, but we know that right now we need kind of a lightning strike moment on some group of senators for it to occur. So that's why I'm wearing this, a mask that says, what?
Vote.
Vote. Because if the court is corrupted, it makes the November 3rd election all that much more important. It means that we need a House and a Senate and an Oval Office dedicated to the vision of equal justice under the law. It means we need a House and a Senate and Oval Office dedicated to the vision of government of, by, and for the people. Yes? So, think about this like a ball game. First base is that group of majority, the grassroots America, taking over, everybody voting. We win that vision on November 3rd, but that's just like first base. Second base, we have to unrig the Senate. Priorities by the Republicans take 51 votes. Priorities for the people that Democrats put forward take 60 votes. They're subject to the McConnell veto. Shall we strike down the McConnell veto? Be ready to fight for that. Because if we do that, we can then pass the For the People Act that takes on gerrymandering, voter suppression, and dark money. We can end the corruption of future elections by passing the For the People Act. Let's fight for that. And then between January and July, let's pass massive reforms on health care, on housing, on education, on living wage jobs, on infrastructure, on the DREAM Act, on the Equality Act, so our LGBT community no longer has doors slammed in their face across America, full opportunity for all. And let's take on climate chaos. And then with those future elections that are unrigged, let's retake and restore a court system in America that fights for the vision of our Constitution instead of riding over the top of it. Thank you for being here in the fight. We have to mobilize, we have to fight in such a determined fashion because we are on the brink of unending government by and for the powerful. We have a chance to turn that around. We have to do that. We have to do it this November 3rd. Thank you and God bless you.
That was Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley speaking at a rally on Capitol Hill today. It's the final face-off between President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden tonight. The two candidates are set to clash in their debate in Nashville starting at 6 Pacific time. NBC's Kristen Welker will moderate the debate, which is scheduled to run for 90 minutes. The announced topics include fighting the coronavirus, American families, race in the United States, climate change, national security, and leadership. This week, a group of Dreamers from Oregon shared their stories of how getting an education has helped them succeed. Portland Community College held an event celebrating their success and to raise money for the new Dreamer Center at the school. They also talked about what's at stake for their future with the U.S. Supreme Court and the upcoming November election.
I am Roberto Suarez, Interim Associate Dean of Students at the Sylvania campus. This is a very difficult time for many of us, but even more so for our Dreamers and DACA students. These students are facing the uncertainty of their futures. During my time at PCC, I had the pleasure of working with many of our Dreamers. I was an academic advisor at a time when there was no financial aid available at all for our Dreamer students, and DACA didn't even exist. And against such adversity, these students understood the value of having a college education, so much so that they would work multiple jobs and complete their requirements, one or two classes per term, whatever they could afford to pursue their academic goals. Now, the term DREAM stands for Development, Relief, and Education of Alien Minors. But at PCC, we don't consider anyone alien. All are welcome. The determination of our Dreamers is truly inspiring and an example to all of us, no matter where they come from. Despite the growing number of challenges our students face, a global pandemic, social injustice and civil unrest, an uncertain political climate, and attending school remotely, our students continue to show their resilience. However, they now need our support more than ever. In 2018, PCC opened its Dream Center, a resource center for Dreamers and DACA students. This would not have been possible without the collaboration, dedication, and support of our community partners. Thank you to the Oregon Immigrant Refugees Funder Collaborative, including LEAP funders, Meyer Memorial Trust, and Oregon Community Foundation, for your investment in making this center a reality. Thanks to the Funders Collaborative grant and the support of our community, we are able to continue to serve our Dreamers and DACA students. Since the creation of the Dream Center, PCC has been supporting and aiding students of all documentation statuses as they pursue their educational goals. In June of this year, the Supreme Court of the United States reached a 5-4 decision to uphold the DACA program, which provides work permits and protection from deportation for close to 800,000 DACA recipients in the U.S. The Supreme Court noted that these individuals relied on the DACA program for continuing to put down roots in our communities by enrolling in degree programs, embarking on careers, launching businesses, purchasing homes, and starting their own families.
As we all know too well, the status of DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, is fragile and uncertain. Our Dreamers students deserve more. This is one of the reasons that PCC is committed to our sanctuary status, to protect the privacy of our students and to maintain a learning environment that is inclusive and welcoming.
We need to be able to support all of our students from different backgrounds who have distinctive needs.
The Dreamers are, you know, marginalized students. And at a very young age, they're being told that college is not attainable to them because they're not documented.
My experience as a Dreamer in educational institutions hasn't been easy.
There's a point where you face so many obstacles as a young person that is documented or undocumented, you start to tell yourself that you can't or that it's not possible.
We are the community college for all folks in our community. It's not just some, it's for all. We became a sanctuary college in January of 2017, but the discussion really started after the election in November of 2016. And there was a palpable shift in the sense of safety on the college campus, with many of our most marginalized students feeling not as safe as a result of the election.
It's really important that PCC is a sanctuary college because that's what gets out to the community.
We're telling our community, mi casa es tu casa. You can come here, you're more than welcome to take classes, you're more than welcome to use the resources. That's what being a sanctuary means. And when people come here, they feel welcome, they feel accepted.
We are the only community college in the state of Oregon to have a Dreamer Center.
The Dreamer Center was created because of a need that students brought forward, where they really felt like they needed a place of support on campus.
The Dream Center is really important because it helps students feel a sense of belonging.
The community at the Dream Center has really helped me. Since we all come from familiar backgrounds, we all can connect and we can all understand each other's struggle.
It feels like family. They'll understand your experience. You don't have to kind of close yourself. You can open yourself to them because they know exactly how you feel.
The center provides resources and support to students. Services like support with completing the DACA renewal, financial resources to help them pay for college, especially when they're not eligible for federal financial aid, support in just navigating our system of education. You know, as first generation students, a lot of them, they just don't understand the process. We provide tuition remission, emergency loans, workshops and community events, leadership opportunities for students, and really providing just a safe place.
I support the Dreamer program because as a faculty person at PCC for 27 years, I met a lot of people who are in these circumstances.
We support our undocumented students.
I just really want to acknowledge the students. Them seeking an education is not only changing their lives, they're impacting their families, so their siblings, and really the entire community, and informing them that college is possible.
I'm super excited about my future.
I feel like I'm part of a community that I belong in.
Undocumented students are members of our community. We want them to be educated. We want them to contribute to our community and to society, and therefore them having the opportunity to access higher education is essential, not only for them, but for all of us.
Those are some of the voices from the Dreamer Center at Portland Community College. for listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned for Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's the Indigenous Power Hour. Tonight's weather will be cold, partly cloudy down to 39. Tomorrow it'll be rainy, up to 51 for the high. Expect below freezing temperatures for the weekend. Today in history, on this date in 1968, Apollo 7 splashed down in the Atlantic Ocean after orbiting the Earth 163 times. Our quote of the day is from astronaut Michael Collins, who said, "I really believe that if the political leaders of the world could see their planet from a distance of, let's say, 100,000 miles, their outlook would be fundamentally changed. The all-important border would be invisible. That noisy argument suddenly silenced." The history of humanity and its future path could be determined by our plans to explore the heavens. A Camas, Washington native and astronaut, Dr. Michael Barrett, recently talked to students and residents in his hometown about his career in space and what's next on the horizon.
I went to the University of Washington for 4 years. I did get my degree in marine zoology there, and I was kind of undergoing a bit of career anxiety. All I wanted to be was an astronomer before I went to college. Then I shifted to marine biology. Then I met this young lady who was going to medical school, so I married her and followed her. And I spent 4 years at the Northwestern University Medical School, then another 4 years during internal medicine. And during that time, I was actually nurturing an interest in space, of all things, and starting to gain contacts in the space medical world. And then I went and actually did training in aerospace medicine, a joint program with Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and Wright State University in Ohio. And then in 1991, I came to the NASA Johnson Space Center. It's a beautiful place, and I've called this home pretty much ever since. My first job there for 9 years or so was to be a flight surgeon. That was my passion, the human in space. How do we adapt? How do we prepare for space flight? What can we learn? How do we make ourselves as good as possible to be explorers? And these were some of my absolute best years. I made some of my closest friendships. Norm Thagard, the first U.S. person to fly long duration on a Russian space station. Peggy Whitson, who was a biochemist at the time. I was a flight surgeon at the time. Little did we know we would both go on to become astronauts. And she is absolutely superwoman in space. And again, one of my closest friends. And Dave Ward was one of the more brilliant flight surgeons I ever knew. He had 17 people who were kind of like me. And the first thing that made them like me is none of us had any idea how and why we got picked to be astronauts. And that's kind of a good thing. Everybody was just really smart, but very humble and just really easy to work with. Otherwise, you had 17 comedians who just really were pathologically interested in spaceflight. A few years go by and lots of training and game day. My first launch was on a Russian Soyuz. And the gentleman on the far left is actually Hungarian-American, also calls Washington home. This is Charles Simonyi, who has a home in Bellevue, Washington. And he was actually flying as a paying participant. And it was his second flight. In the middle was Gennady Padalka, a Russian gentleman, one of the best space flyers in the business, and the recordsman for duration in space. And I was extremely lucky to fly with these guys, and they are my lifelong friends. And we flew on the Russian Soyuz. How fast do we have to go to get into orbit? Well, that's 17,500 miles an hour. That's pretty fast. And we do it all in about 8 minutes and 45 seconds. So that's orbital velocity. So it only takes a little over 8.5 minutes to go from the ground into space, into low Earth orbit. I'm shortening that, but it's a very exciting 8.5 minutes. A lot of shake, rattle, and roll, and you're watching your speed indicator go up. It's really quite exciting. Then my next launch was on the space shuttle. The space shuttle Discovery was actually the last flight of that bird, and it was just a real honor to fly on that mission. Same numbers, though. A little over 8.5 minutes, you are going 17,500 miles an hour. So that's what it takes to stay in low Earth orbit. This is the current most popular destination in low Earth orbit, the International Space Station. It is big. It's absolutely gorgeous. To give you a sense of scale, it's longer than a football field, and all the people are on the inside and the modules in the middle. So it's still pretty big. I mean, everybody could potentially have their own two modules if they wanted them. And you have to get used to zero gravity. And so everything is just going to float around and fly around. And believe me, it does take a while to get used to that so that you're not losing stuff all the time or not running into things all the time. But actually, after a certain amount of time, it's just absolutely magical to be up there. And mainly what we do on station is science. science. The reason we have this big, magnificent platform is to serve as a laboratory. And it tells us about the human in space, but it tells us things about medicine and physiology and physics, other parts of science that you just can't see when you're on the Earth. When you remove gravity, you find things. And we have found so many things way beyond what we expected up there. And so the science output of the ISS has just been tremendous. It's a bilingual station. Everybody has to speak English and Russian up there. So that foreign language skill is a really important thing. Any chance you can to either preserve another language that's in your house or learn another language, I would say take it, because everything we do now is very international. And I was lucky enough to do two spacewalks. I actually did them both in the Russian spacesuits, and Gennady and I were lucky enough to take out the new generation Orlan suits, and that was just really exciting. When we're up there and we're looking at the Earth, there's no borders, there's no lines on the map. So you have to learn geography in another way, but it also gives you an idea of what the Earth has just been like for so many centuries, thousands of years before people came along and made maps in the first place. And it's just a totally different perspective. And you can see the Earth in many different shapes and forms and seasons. You can see ocean on the left and on the right of the Western African desert. It's impossibly beautiful. And I would just say that if there's anything that we could share, any one experience that we could share with everybody, it would be the view of your home planet from space. And in particular, at night, when you want to see where people live, you look at the footprint of humanity outlined by its city lights. It was just incredibly beautiful. Let's pretend 6.5 months has gone by and it's time to land. You're used to zero gravity, not terrestrial gravity, not Earth gravity anymore. And you hit the ground pretty hard in the Soyuz. It's a brilliant system and it gets you down, and it's just really good to smell fresh air and to hear human voices besides your crew again. Shuttle landed a little bit differently, kind of like a big cargo plane on a runway. So the shuttle was kind of a rough launch, but a very gentle landing. That's kind of been my path and my experience. Let's shift to kind of what we're doing now. The SpaceX Dragon and the Starliner on the top, those are being built and flown, either test flown or operationally flown right now. And the Dream Chaser, the mini shuttle we have on contract to start delivering cargo to the space station. So that's happened. Blue Origin, separate from NASA, is developing also a crew carrier that will get to low Earth orbit. So the point being, there's never been a time when so many different human-carrying spacecraft were being built by different enterprises, different purposes, different reasons, but a lot of commonality. And NASA is at the center of a lot of these projects. The big change now is getting out of low Earth orbit. And that's what Artemis is all about. It's time to break orbit and go explore. We've been in space for 20 years continual on the ISS, which is great, but we haven't been out of low Earth orbit since the very early 70s. It is far time to go do that. And that's what Artemis is going to let us do. In the last century, we needed the Apollo program for many reasons. A lot of you may know there was a space race with the Russians, who are now our colleagues in space, which I think really rocks, actually. But there were reasons to develop our technology quickly and show that we could get to the moon. It was an amazing program, but as noted, it was limited. And the motion is outward. The movement of humanity is outward from our planet. We're going to stay here. Don't worry about that. We're not evacuating. We're expanding. And that is the direction every country is going as the means to do that. Our next step is going to be going back to the moon to stay, to sustain. Now, we're going to some very challenging places. And this shows the South Pole and the Schrodinger Impact Basin, which is a massive crater. There's craters all over the moon. But these are the places that are extremely interesting because they have shaded regions that might have abundant water ice. And they're also geologically very interesting, but they're also very challenging. They're not quite the straight and level ground that we landed on during the Apollo years. They're harder to get to, and they're harder to navigate. This puts us into kind of a more pure exploration mode. But again, we're doing it to build infrastructure and to stay, which is really cool. To do that, we need a big rocket. So we're developing this space launch system, which will be a massive, sort of back in the Apollo class boosters and eventually larger. We need to be able to throw large masses up towards the moon to get people and their equipment up there. It's extremely exciting to be building new spacecraft. And this is part US, and the lower stage there is actually provided by the European Space Agency. So also international. And another one of our targets is to build another station far from low Earth orbit, but really in the vicinity of the moon. That will give us a springboard to get to other parts of the moon that were a lot harder to get to or impossible to get to with the Apollo architecture. So it's very exciting to be building another station, even a more remote one, a more remote outpost. And what I also find very exciting, a lot of my daily work is providing medical input to these new programs that are developing potential lunar landers. So we had a lunar lander in the Apollo system. We need one now. We need a bigger one, a much more capable one. And we're looking at three different designs right now. So again, this is happening and it's really quite exciting. We'll have to choose. Where we're going to explore is very challenging. Some of these areas are going to be permanently shaded. They're going to be very cold. And geologically, the terrain is going to be difficult. Steep, large boulders, craters, and very, very interesting from an exploration standpoint. This is also part of a bigger picture. This is a stepping stone, but it's a huge stepping stone on a path outward towards Mars. Now, when you think about the ISS, it's a big platform in orbit, which is great. Think about the Moon. It's an even bigger platform in orbit. It's just a little higher than the ISS, but it is literally like a God-given space station that will help us move out in the solar system to explore.
That was Camas, Washington native and astronaut Dr. Michael Barrett. You are listening to a Fall Membership Drive special of the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, so we encourage your participation. You can call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Althea Billings, and Annette Newell. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Stay tuned for KBOO News In-Depth, coming up next.
KABU News In-Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. Today on KABU News In-Depth, I'm speaking with Democratic candidate for Secretary of State, Shamia Fagan. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me today, Shamia. You're running for Secretary of State, and folks most commonly associate that office with the administration of elections. We are now less than 2 weeks out from Election Day, and anxieties related to voting and the safety of our elections are pretty high. Now, in Oregon, we have had mail-in voting for a generation, so the attacks we have seen nationally on that system don't necessarily ring true. However, a story broke today from a crisis mapping group called ACLED that lists Oregon as a state that is at risk for militia activity around the election. What does Oregon do well when it comes to safe and fair elections, and where should we look to improve?
Well, first off, folks are correct to associate this office, the Secretary of State's office, with running elections. In fact, I think of the 50 Secretaries of State, 49 of them in the country administer elections. Other duties that Oregon has may not be shared across other Secretaries of State, but this one is one that we all share. So it's something that's very high up, and I would consider it the most important role of Oregon's Secretary of State. Oregon has done vote by mail for over 20 years. In fact, I've never voted any other way. I remember when I was still in high school out in Wasco County in the Dalles, my dad voting for the first time with vote by mail when I still lived with him. And so this is what we have done well, which is really the model for the nation. Number one, we have a paper trail. So for every ballot, we have a paper trail. So they're easily audited. Number two, we have forensic signature verification, which means that when somebody signs the back of that that envelope, they have to then match that signature, and they use forensic signature verification. And we give folks an opportunity to fix it if their signature has changed from when they first registered to vote and they're signing their ballot now, which happened to me during the 2008 election when I voted for President Obama. Number three, we have a unique barcode tracking system. So every ballot that is turned in, even if folks were to get multiple ballots because say a ballot came late, and so they had ordered another one, people can only turn in one ballot because every registered voter has a unique barcode tracking tag that would show that their ballot has been received and counted. And then number four, we don't connect our counting machines to the internet. So we don't have to worry about anybody that seeks to do harm actually hacking our system because they're not connected to the internet. So those are the things that Oregon has done really, really well. The places where we can do better are, number one, we need to increase the security of our online voter registration system. while we do meet the federal standards right now, let's do better than the federal minimum, right? Let's make sure that this system that allows for online voter registration, online ballot tracking, online address updating, that we make sure that is not susceptible to any kind of hacking. Number two, I think that we should allow ballots that are postmarked by Election Day to be counted, as they do in other states that do vote by mail. And number three, I believe that we should allow same-day voter registration for folks that decide, you know, late in the game to register, newly moved to Oregon, or in a primary that decide they want to actually vote for a particular candidate so they could register for that party. And then the other thing that we need to do that I think would really be helpful in this election is ballot tracking. So in three of our 36 counties, Multnomah, Marion, and Yamhill, folks can actually opt in to get a text message when their ballot has been received. And I've been seeing people put screenshots of that all over Instagram and Facebook and Twitter, because that comfort, okay, my ballot has been received, my ballot has been counted. And so that's something I think we should implement in all 36 Oregon counties.
Looking past the election next year, states will be asked to redraw their electoral districts based on the 2020 census. When your Republican opponent, Kim Thatcher, was interviewed on KABU, she alluded to the fact that you, as a Democrat, would not lead a fair redistricting commission. What is your response to that?
Well, that she's the only person between the two of us who, as a politician, actually voted yes to draw her own district's boundaries back in 2011. And of course, she drew herself a nice, safe Republican district in the House and the Senate that she's never had any kind of real competition, because there's so many more Republicans than Democrats in that district. So between the two of us, she's the only one who has voted to give herself a very safe district where she is not able to be challenged. I have been independent from my party in multiple times. I've been the lone no vote in my party on multiple occasions. In fact, in endorsing me, the Bend Bulletin wrote that I have been willing to buck my party's establishment to do what I believe in right is right. And redistricting is one of those places, because despite potentially having the authority to unilaterally redistrict, as secretaries of state have done in the past, I have already committed to using a nonpartisan people's commission that would be independent from me. I would, you know, obviously make sure that they were doing the complying with the law, but the Constitution and ORS Chapter 188 that lays out the requirements for redistricting, but that I would use a people's commission that's rooted in racial equity. Because one of the things that distinguishes me from Senator Thatcher is I've definitely been willing to recognize, the ways in which our country has failed communities of color and BIPOC folks. And one of those ways, when we're talking about the redistricting, we also were talking about the census. And we talk about the census, we have to recognize that when our country was first founded, not all human beings were counted in the census as full people because of the three-fifths compromise. And so that is something that I think is really important. So any people's commission that we use to do redistricting has to be rooted in racial equity and historically underrepresented communities.
Oregon's current Secretary of State is Bev Clarno, a Republican who was appointed to finish the term started by Dennis Richardson. If you win, Democrats will have control of both houses of the state legislature, the governorship, and the Secretary of State. And that trifecta has worried opponents who fear their voice may not be heard in state government. What would you say to them? How does bipartisanship or even nonpartisanship play a role in the Secretary of State's office?
Well, as a democracy, nobody has control. In fact, Senator Thatcher is a Republican senator from the Kaiser area. And if I'm to win the Secretary of State's office, she'll continue to represent her district as a Republican senator. And there are many, many Republican senators and Republican members of the House. Just to be clear, those folks are at the table. They're typically vice chairs of committees. They have full staff and full availability to participate in the process. But in a democracy, Oregonians get to choose the leaders who reflect their values. And I think what folks are seeing in this election is that Senator Thatcher, particularly when it comes to voting rights, when it comes to issues of equity, she simply does not share values with Oregonians. I mean, I, on the one hand, don't believe that expanding voting rights, for example, should be a partisan issue. So when we voted for things like automatic voter registration or prepaid postage that certainly benefit more rural areas, that some of them tend to vote Republican, Senator Thatcher voted against those expansions of democracy. Fortunately, across the country, as people have adopted automatic voter registration, now Republican legislatures and Republican governors have signed that into law. But here in Oregon, Senator Thatcher voted with her party against those expansions of democracy. So the bottom line is, I don't believe that any political party, Republican or Democrat, deserves a position of leadership in Oregon. What Oregonians deserve is a debate on the issues and to see the differences between the candidates and to choose the candidate who most reflects their values on accessing democracy, which is why almost every newspaper in the state, I believe only one small paper has endorsed her. Every other paper, from the East Oregonian to the Willamette Week to the Portland Mercury to the Scanner News, including down in Southern Oregon and up in the northwestern tip of Oregon, Astoria, have endorsed me because they recognize that I am more in line with Oregon values when it comes to expanding access to democracy.
The Secretary of State in Oregon also oversees the audit division. The Oregon Employment Department has been under a lot of scrutiny since the pandemic has forced so many out of their jobs. In your platform, you've said that the Secretary of State in its audit capacity can help that situation. How would that work?
Well, first off, the Oregon Employment Department, which of course oversees the unemployment insurance program, is absolutely right to face scrutiny. Let me be clear, it is absolutely unacceptable that so many Oregonians who have paid into this payroll tax, this insurance benefit, their entire working lives, many folks, this is the first time they've ever had to access it. And yet many folks are still waiting for their checks. If they're still not waiting for them, they were waiting for months for those checks. And so I am proud to be the only one between Senator Thatcher and myself who voted in favor of making sure folks can't be evicted from their homes that are renters during the COVID crisis, that folks can't be foreclosed on by their mortgage companies during the COVID crisis. Senator Thatcher voted against those, allowing folks to be kicked out of their homes. Fortunately, the majority was with me, but there's no moratorium on paying your grocery bill. There's no moratorium on putting gas in the car or paying for your prescription medications or getting your grandkids a birthday gift or paying childcare. And so it is unacceptable. And so I have committed, in fact, we have a commercial out right now talking about, look, I understand what it's like for families to be hanging on by a thread. And I think that the audits division is the most powerful tool the Secretary of State has to make sure that our policies reflect our values. And when it comes to the Oregon Employment Department, that will be the first audit that I will pursue as Secretary of State, not only finding out what went wrong in 2020, but we're going to go deeper. We're going to say what went wrong in previous years when there have already been audits of the Oregon Employment Department with strong recommendations that could have prevented this situation. Why weren't those recommendations followed? We're going to also audit that to find out what can we do as Secretary of State to make sure that recommendations are followed through.
Let's talk about your work as a state legislator. You've served both in the Oregon House of Representatives and in the state Senate. When you think about your achievements, what are you most proud of?
Well, as I've already mentioned, I've been at the forefront of every major expansion of access to democracy, from automatic voter registration to working with Republicans to pass the National Popular Vote Compact over the objection of the three most powerful Democrats in the Senate. But I believed it was the right thing to do. And then prepaid postage most recently. All of those relate directly to the Secretary of State's office. But the first bill that I ever was the chief co-sponsor of was actually the bill to create the Office of Small Business Assistance right in the Secretary of State's office. That was my first bill as a freshman legislator to make sure that small businesses have that advocate in the Secretary of State's office. And I'm proud to say that that program is not only going well, it is actually internationally acclaimed as a program that really helps small businesses have that one-stop shop to call if they're having any problems with permitting, or if they get a letter in the mail from a government agency and they don't know what it means, or even in private disputes or interactions. I'm very proud of that. But for the most part, I have spent my term working on things like, as I just mentioned, small businesses, helping folks access democracy, but also helping families that are hanging on by a thread. That's kind of how I grew up. My dad was a single parent. My mom battled meth and opioid addiction. Both my dad and my mom, we battled homelessness as a family. And so I have spent my career fighting for other families that are hanging on by a thread. And so I've been proud to vote in favor of raising the minimum wage. I've been proud to vote in favor of paid sick leave for Oregon workers, the things that Senator Thatcher voted against. I've been proud to help lead the efforts on things like, reasonable gun safety regulations. Having grown up in rural Oregon, it's simply a myth that folks don't think we should have background checks on gun sales, which I was proud to support. Senator Thatcher not only voted no on that, but she was seen at a rally shouting, "I will not comply," basically saying she won't follow the law when it comes to something as simple as background checks on gun sales. So when it comes to my service in the legislature, I've been doing things to help Oregon families provide help small businesses thrive, help people access democracy, and help Oregon families be safer through gun safety regulation and expanded health care.
The Secretary of State in Oregon is an office with a lot of different responsibilities, some of which we've touched on, and the 2020 election in general is complicated and there's a lot to take in as a voter. What's one issue in this race that you think doesn't get quite enough attention?
I would say that it's the state land board, because that is a constitutional responsibility of the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State, the governor, and the treasurer sit on the state land board, which oversees, in large part, the common school fund, which is some unclaimed property, but mostly it's lands that were given to Oregon when we became a state in 1859. And one of the major pieces of land that the state land board oversees is the Elliott Forest, which is our largest old growth forest, about 82,000 acres on Oregon's central coast. And there have been efforts in the past from private timber companies to buy this 82,000 acre Oregon treasure and, of course, chop it up and so they could make money. And Senator Thatcher is supported by those timber companies that want to do that. But I'm so proud to have gone into the meeting with those timber companies. And when they asked me about that, I said unequivocally, I'm going to give you the same answer that I would give a room full of environmental activists, which is I will not sell the Elliott Forest to private logging interests. I believe it should be publicly owned with public recreation access, habitat conservation, and of course, reasonable logging when that can be sustained with the habitat and the recreation. And so I think the state land board's position is overlooked often, but it's really, really important. Oregon has a long history of conservation values, and I'm proud to be endorsed by both the Sierra Club and the Oregon League of Conservation Voters.
Finally, why should voters elect you as the next Oregon Secretary of State?
Well, voters have a clear choice in this election. If folks have been paying attention, watching the debates, even these interviews on KBOO, they're going to see they have a choice between someone who has spent her legislative career voting with her party to restrict access to democracy and someone who has led the fight to expand access. Somebody who has stayed silent when the president and his allies have spread misinformation and conspiracy theories that undermine public health and our democracy, and someone in me who has stood up to those lies. And somebody who is really propped up by right-wing organizations like Oregon Firearms Federation, the anti-vaccine movement, the anti-choice movement like Senator Thatcher, and someone who's supported by the organizations and folks that Oregonians have been trusting for decades. I'm very proud to be endorsed by Senators Merkley and Wyden, by the American Postal Workers Union, by Planned Parenthood, by the Oregon teachers and firefighters and nurses and healthcare workers who have been on the front lines of this COVID crisis. But I'm not done until I can add all of your listeners to that list. And so my name is Shamia Fagan, and I'm asking for your vote either in November or in October, whenever you and your family sit down to vote safely by mail here in Oregon.
That was my conversation with Democratic candidate for Oregon Secretary of State, Shamia Fagan. A reminder that Oregonians must mail in their ballots by October 28th or drop them off at an official drop box location by Election Day, Tuesday, November 3rd. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for listening.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
All right. right. Hey ho, let's go. This is Mark Allendary. Sitting across the table from me is Doc Griggs. And this is one of our favorite segments in which we get to talk about some of the public health updates for the past week. Before we get started, there are a couple things that I think are important for us to go over. One is that we talked about a week ago or so that the estimates here in the US for antibodies, in other words, those individuals that have tested positive in the past, is about 10%. The WHO this past week also came up with a similar number globally. So it looks like we're looking at a 10% both global and here in the US.
Yeah, that's kind of scary.
The other thing that I think is really important that I think that y'all are going to be hearing is this thing called the Great Barrington Declaration. And I just want to tear it down right now before any of you think that there may be some merit to this.
You're going to make it so it's not so great?
Yes. So these are these three infectious disease scientists, and there's an epidemiologist or two, and I think even one of my colleagues, an infectious diseases physician. And basically, this proposal is essentially going to lead to isolating vulnerable, disabled, and older people so as to get to this idea of herd immunity. This is not medically savvy. I don't think anybody recognizes this as being a valid solution to the COVID-19 pandemic. I think there was two more really interesting stories that came out of the news last week. One was that California added a COVID-19 equity requirement to their counties before they were allowed to reopen. In other words, the county had to make sure that those individuals that were in the lower socioeconomic status of that community had to have the same test positivity rate as the entire county. So this way, it made sure that everybody was at the same level when the county opened, and they were referring to that as their equity requirement. And I think that's awesome.
That's amazing.
Yes. And then lastly, I wanted to recognize that Dr. Fauci did warn Americans last week that we need to rethink Thanksgiving and coronavirus as a result of the surges. At the time of this recording right now, I don't know if you know this, but we had the highest, we exceeded 400,000 cases on Friday, the last time that Doc Griggs and I recorded.
Really?
Yes. And also that day we had 71,000 cases here in the US. So
wait, 400,000 cases as of Friday?
As a global, right. Wow. So essentially, Dr. Fauci is telling people, please stay home and please continue to mask more than anything else.
Now, if I remember correctly, we had been talking about how the holidays were going to look different months ago.
Right.
Yeah. Would you say,
that's a very good
hear
point.
Me today, quote me tomorrow?
Right.
There's no hearing or quotes. We literally said this months ago that Thanksgiving and, well, we said Halloween, Thanksgiving, and Christmas were going to be very, very different.
Right.
Who knew?
So now on to the stories. So let's talk about COVID-19 and masking. So there was a really great article. It was a study that actually had come out. It was the Pentagon who did it, and it was actually the Department of Defense. And what they essentially were trying to answer is, what are the risks of contracting COVID-19 when traveling aboard a large commercial aircraft when most people are wearing masks? Now, we have documented here on Noise Filter, and we reviewed several studies that showed that when people were not wearing masks, so before the pandemic started, or before the lockdown started and the mask requirement started, people who were on airplanes were transmitting virus, and we have talked about it here on Noise Filter. So what the Pentagon did was they took an airline, one of the commercial airlines, and they flew it 300 times in the air, on the ground, while they were taxiing, and they put a mannequin in there, and that mannequin was coughing up aerosolized, so not droplets, aerosolized particles that were the same size of the virus. And they set up 41 monitors or 42 sensors all over and in and around the plane. And the mannequin was wearing a mask. And so what they found was that it was far lower than 1% that would have a potential viral exposure or viral infection.
That would be infected.
Right, that could be potentially affected, right. And that was largely due, one, to the fact of mask wearing, and two, even more importantly, to the amount of air exchange and how aggressive ventilation. So we have said over and over again on Noise Filter,
ventilation.
It's all about mask wearing, it's all about ventilation. Now, listen, there were some huge problems with this, and I just want to be very clear, there were some limitations. Again, they did not look at droplets, they did not look at eating, they did not look at drinking. So what happens when somebody's walking around the airplane? What happens if somebody's eating, or what happens if they're drinking? But I would say, like I told you just a couple days ago, Doc Griggs, I'm still cautiously optimistic.
Oh, no, here is the science, folks. This, what I was saying was, I don't know if you heard this. The scientific process has been exposed, right? This is stuff that happens behind the scenes, and they've been discrediting us the whole time.
Right.
What you need to understand is, folks, we as scientists study everything.
Right.
Everything. They rigged a mannequin to cough, put a mask on it, set sensors up all around the cabin of an airplane just because we want people to understand. Now, there's some more stories that are going to come up that you'll see the scientific process. You talk, we listen, we study.
Right.
We show you the results, even if they don't agree with what you think. The whole purpose of science is to be objective, but can y'all imagine what that looked like with a coughing dummy with a mask on?
Well, we've done that a couple times. Yeah. We've seen.
You talking about me? You call me a coughing dummy? Oh, no.
But listen, but I will say, you know what was, I don't want to say what was dumb, but I can't believe, I feel sort of dumb having to talk about it.
No, you're
which,
not dumb.
Which is the next story, which was how they had to test for overexposure to carbon dioxide.
Hey, Doc, watch, I'm going to hold my breath.
So in this study, we've heard a lot of folks say that they don't want to wear masks because of potential overexposure to carbon dioxide. So it doesn't really work like that, because I just want to remind everybody that carbon dioxide is a carbon atom with di, so that's two O2
oxygens.
Atoms.
Yeah.
And so how small is that carbon dioxide molecule?
Wait.
It's smaller. I'm trying to put my fingers together.
Let me squint.
Yeah, it's really smaller than that. It's really small, right? So could an atom, when it's being blown out of your mouth, or molecule rather, consisting of carbon and two oxygen, can it just go right through the material of the mass?
Imagine a minnow swimming through a tuna fishing net.
Right.
Yeah, it's
going to just go right through. Yeah. So essentially with this, or water going through a chain link fence.
Or carbon dioxide going through a cloth mask.
Even N95. Yeah. So essentially what these pulmonologists did was they just basically took 15 residents, which were young, healthy doctors.
Poor residents. They just use us however they see fit, right?
And then they took older kind of veterans, right, that had lung disease. Mm-hmm. And they basically tested them to see if there was any CO2 build up as a result of them doing a couple of walking exercises or whatever when they wore a mask. And guess what? Yes.
They could breathe.
Yes. The small study failed to demonstrate any gas exchange abnormalities. So for anybody who says that the mask is covering my face and it's limiting my oxygen intake, or it's prohibiting carbon dioxide from being emitted from the mask, that is not true. We now have a study that actually shows it.
But here again, here is the scientific process. You talk, you complain, you pay attention, and we listen. We absolutely listen because we test it.
That's right.
Now we have data to support it.
Okay, so now let's talk about COVID-19 and viral transmission. These are a couple of topics that are near and dear to my heart. So real quick, I'm just going to kind of summarize a couple of studies that I thought that were really interesting last week. One was looking at super spreading events. Now, this is something that Doc Griggs and I talk about all the time, is what happens. And so the study essentially looked at the very beginning of the outbreak. And what they found by looking at the gene sequences of viruses that was found at the beginning of the outbreak, that a very small number of people were responsible for a large number of infections, whereas a large amount of people were not responsible for one-to-one transmission. Now, that the only exception is for people that live in house. So if people live in the same house as somebody that's infected with COVID, it's they
proximity,
could
proximity,
lack
exposure,
of ventilation, all that. Yep. But what they found was this, and we've talked about it before, is that there are these people who are considered super spreaders. And so this one article focused in on that, but it links up with, because our producer, Graham, also sent us an article, and this... He sent me the article, and I wrote back. I said, yeah, this is a great article. It's really academic. Let me find out if anybody else is talking about this. And literally the first paper I opened after that was,
who knew?
Was exactly that. So we have to talk about it. So again, I want everybody to recognize not everybody transmits COVID. We refer to that as homogeneous.
Yeah.
There is not a homogeneous transmission.
And we're looking for what were the cause for the difference?
Yeah, well, yes.
Yeah.
But also, equally as important, Eric, I will say this, is trying to identify who the super spreaders are.
Right.
And that's, I think, the next step of COVID-19.
Yeah. This right. stuff is fascinating. Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Dr. Derry and I have a daily show at 4 p.m. Central Standard Time where we go into more detail on stories and answer your questions about COVID-19.
You can find Doc Griggs at DocGriggs1 on social media, and you can find me at Dr. Mark Allen Derry or at DRDERY. You can follow us at Noise Filter on Instagram, Noise Filter NOLA on Twitter, and for more information about us and the show, you can go to noisefiltershow.com. Hey, Doc Griggs, any last words?
Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving, and remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
Estás escuchando KBOO.